Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Bob Pressler, 53 years of combination experience, second-generation firefighter, retired lieutenant with the FDNY and current deputy fire chief with Christiana Fire Department in Delaware. Bob always knew he wanted to be a firefighter. He tested everywhere he could to make sure it would come to fruition. He wanted to go big, so being a northerner, FDNY was the cream of the crop. Bob was able to obtain so many experiences through the many fires he was able to go to. Our discussions ranged from forcible entry, being internet fire famous, all the way to how Christiana does things, and I thoroughly enjoyed every minute of it. I hope the listeners tuning in can pick up a few gems Bob was putting down. With that, I present Bob Pressler.
Bob Pressler, I've been in the fire service for, I guess, going on 53 years, which makes me kind of old. I started when my dad became chief in a little town in North Jersey called Creskill, New Jersey. And he started a junior fireman program. So what's pretty odd about that is I was actually, there's a picture of me that was in the Daily News. I think it was 1966. I was the mascot for the junior fireman because I wasn't old enough to be a junior yet. So that got me started, spent a lot of time at the firehouse. And then as I grew older, I joined the juniors. And then in 1972, when I turned 18, I became an interior fireman. And that's, you know, my whole growing up time was spent in the firehouse. So, you know, that just became the normal thing for me. My dad did a lot of things that were interesting back then. 1967, Creskill bought a Quint, which was kind of unheard of back then. You know, the way they looked at it, it was the Department of Public Works did most of their daytime response, and they were lucky to get one truck. So they might as well have one truck that could do everything they needed. And, you know, and since now, Quints are pretty common, but back then they really weren't. So became an interior fireman, went to Oklahoma State University for 2 years. Came back, took a couple odd jobs, and then a little place called Summit, New Jersey, was giving a test for firemen. And it wasn't civil service, it was a chief's test. So a pretty funny story with that is I got out what they called the ARCO books at the time. Went out and bought the newest ARCO book, did the whole book, and all it was a series of questions based on what they would normally give in a civil service test. So I do the entire book. I have about 3 weeks left before the test. I got to keep studying. So I go to the library to see if they have an ARCO book. And the only one they have is probably 2 issues older than the one that I had bought brand new. But I'm like, hey, the question type is the same. So I do 5-6 tests in that. Comes test day, start the test. I turn the first page. I get to the second page. I go, well, I'm not passing this test. I get to the third page and I go, wow, that question's familiar. There was 25 questions from the book I got out of the library. So I started basically with a 25, placed number one on the list, and got hired in Summit, New Jersey. But I wanted to go to a bigger city, so I kept trying. I took Jersey City's test. I took a test in New Jersey that basically gave you access to about 10 different departments, but they ended up changing the rules. And they were now allowed to hire from residents first. And they never told anybody. I was number, I think, 17 in Patterson. I was a young kid. I would have moved to Patterson. But I don't get called. So now I take the New York test. And I end up getting called for Jersey City 3 days before I ended up getting called for New York. So I had friends in Jersey City. They told the people that I was skiing in Vermont. They hadn't been able to get a hold of me. They held my spot for 3 days, and then I got called for New York City. And that started my career in New York City.
Okay. Now, did you have to go through some sort of academy when you got hired with New York? or?
Oh, absolutely. The thing that's funny, it was only 6 weeks. And this is going to sound odd to a lot of people. Now academies are anywhere up to 18 months, 24 months, up to a year long, depending on where you go and what they want you to be when you come out. But basically, we learned fire department stuff, fireman stuff, stretching lines, throwing ladders, forcing doors, searching. But we just did the basics. And really, to me, that is the secret that's kept me going this long, is the basics don't fail. And everything, every day on the internet, there's some new way of doing something, and most of it won't stand the test of time. It's just the pure basics, and when you master them, that gives you the ability to now look at the new stuff and say, okay, hey, let me try that. Nope, that doesn't work any better than what I've been doing. I teach a lot of forcible entry, and to me, that's the biggest one. Everybody wants to try the new neat thing and look at this, look at that. We mark our tools, we do this, we do that. And when you get out in the field, most of it really doesn't do what people intend it to do. What they want it to do is make them internet famous. And unfortunately, that's a lot of the fire service right now.
Yes, no, for sure, for sure. With that being said, you brought it up. I'm going to ask you one of the, I don't want to say a hot topic, but a pretty good conversation starter is to shock the door or not.
Yep. So it's funny. I just read a post the other day and about 15, 18 people commented on it. And everyone was saying, oh, yeah, I shocked the door and the door flew open. Well, that's one of the reasons we don't shock the door, because you don't know what's going on behind that door. And if it opened with you shocking it, you probably could have done it just by using the ads and getting a gap, probably would have done the same thing. So the way we look at it, and this is everybody I think I've ever taught with, is that, Bobby Morris in New York City is probably the one that started the movement to shock. And he has forced a million doors, and maybe he can tell what it sounds like. But for most people, they have no idea. And I say the shocking the door became real popular when we went to all metal forcible entry doors for props. Because when you bang on it, it sounds real cool. So people weren't up, bam, bam, bam. They don't know why they're doing it. They don't know what they're listening for. So it's just become the thing to do. I don't teach shocking. I don't believe in it. We've got a couple little things that we've always done, and I think it gives us the same advantage. So you take a door with three locks in it, a doorknob lock, two deadbolts. You hitting the door probably is not going to tell you unless you're real good about which one of those three locks is locked. So what we developed, and we were doing it because of automatic alarms chasing food of stoves and senior citizens housing, we just take the ads in at the top of the door on the doorknob side and just crack that seal a little bit. One, if that's your apartment, you're going to get a little smoke or a stronger smell. But two, when you bear down on the Halligan, if it deflects all the way down to the doorknob lock, that's the only one that's locked. If it deflects only to that top area where the top one is locked. But hitting the door is going to tell you, is it the top lock and the doorknob lock, the middle lock and the doorknob lock, just the two deadbolts. So we don't teach it, especially for younger firefighters, because they're not going to be able to get any information from that. That's the way I've always believed it. So I'm not a door shocker.
Okay. But I'm assuming you're probably a proponent of putting your foot on the bottom of the door, giving it just a little push.
So the funniest thing about that is people put their foot on the bottom of the door and then they go above the doorknob lock to try to force it.
Yeah, that would
So that's,
I'd start at the bottom.
yeah. So we've always started at the top because if there's conditions behind the door, once you start to pop the door, the conditions will come out and go above you,
Okay.
right? Where if I start low and I do get a break, and let's say it's banged to the floor behind it, now everything else I'm doing is going to be in that smoke seeping out. So we've always started high. I believe in starting high. So yeah, I don't put my foot against the door. Now,
Okay.
if it was a real tough door, or it looks like it had maybe four locks up the door, then I might try that. But you're still not going after the hardest locks.
Gotcha.
Those deadbolts, right, are the ones a doorknob lock throws about that far, where, a half an inch, it's just the one on the doorknob, where your deadbolts can go 3/4 of an inch, 1.5 inches into the jamb. So those are the ones that are going to fight back, right? So we basically will always start high, work our way down. And if the doorknob lock is the last one, we're using all the force generated by the metal door, putting pressure against the doorknob lock. That one becomes the easiest. We've beat the hard ones coming down, and now that last one will just go.
Okay. I am kind of curious, which you might be able to have the answer to this or not, but all these fabricating companies, they all use thick metal doors. Would it be better to use a thick wooden door, seeing how most re depending on where you live, but like for me, where I live, most of the doors at in these homes are wood.
Yep. Well, the problem is the wood door won't take the beating.
Gotcha.
They've made them all out of metal because that's the only thing that'll stand the test of time. If you look, one of the most popular doors, we refer to it as the blue door. And you can go online and there's 50 videos of forcing that door basically the wrong way with the forks the wrong way. And what happens is because that door and most of almost all the early doors had springs on the hinge side, right? That's what gave the door the ability to move. So as you start to gap the door and drove the forks in, the springs would compress. So you could drive a Halligan in either way, and now you're only fighting against the springs in a piece of wood. Newer doors and homemade doors have done away with the springs, so there is no give. Now it's pure learning forceful entry. And if you put the forks in the wrong way on a newer good door, when you go to give that force, those forks are popping out because that's what happens in real life. Right? There's a reason the forks have to go behind the jamb. And the doors with the springs, it's made it easier to do it the wrong way and be successful. And that's a big problem. The new thing now is everybody loves the baseball swing. And they're
Yes.
using it on a house that has just a doorknob lock, and they're going up there and they're swinging, whack in there, wow, one pop. That door you probably could have leaned on and gotten. So that's become the new skill. That's all people want to do. So we have that blue door. We actually took that block of wood off it. We don't want them practicing that. It's too one-dimensional. Right, we teach the same way every door you go to, and we've been tremendously successful with it.
Okay. All right. Love it. Upon completion of the academy, what was your first assignment?
Out of the academy, I went to 255 Engine in Brooklyn, which today is one of the most sought after spots in the whole fire department. They were just starting to get busy when I was there. And have just gotten busier since I've left. So that was, 1979, and they were just starting to get the fire duty. It was coming down out of Brownsville and East New York and Bed-Stuy. It was slowly moving south. So a good spot, learned a lot. Ended up, working in the truck there also. But those two spots, 255 and 157, to this day are probably two of the hardest spots to get into in the fire department.
Okay. And with getting assigned there, did you have an issue back then of firemen that were not into the job like you're seeing today, where firemen are just being hired for the schedule, the pension, things like that?
So that was an interesting place because a lot of guys had gravitated there because it was slower. They had done their time in the busier places. And a lot of them still lived in Brooklyn because south of there was still a lot of firemen down in there. So there was a pretty good mix there. There was a bunch of people that were up and coming that wanted to be real good. There was a mix of older guys that were just trying to get through their time. But it's different today. The ones there, the ones that didn't want to go to fires, had pretty much gone to a ton of fires already. But I think every place you go, there's always going to be that mix. I think now there's just more people that are looking to not do the work. Where there was always people. And now, again, if you come out of probie school now and go to a good shop, they want to go to fires. But out of the 50 people assigned to the firehouse, there's still five or seven or eight that don't want to go to any more fires. But as long as the house generates the people that want to go to work, that's the atmosphere that creates those good firemen. I use Christiana as an example all the time. In the last 7 years, we've sent, our people to Philly, New York City, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., Wilmington, Delaware. They've all gotten career positions, and almost everyone has gone to a good spot. You know why? We created firemen. They understand the firehouse culture. They know what they're supposed to do. They want to go to work. They want to drill. They want to get better. And that's the whole thing. We've taken people that hadn't even been in the fire service or had very little exposure, and we've made them terrific firemen. And that's a culture. That's what you want. The culture of being the best that you can be, wanting to train, wanting to go to fires, going to drill, keeping the firehouse clean. All those things are part of, the culture of a good firehouse.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Okay. And with that, did you find yourself finding individuals that fit that mold? Meaning, did you find a mentor growing up, growing through the ranks of the FDNY?
Yeah, every place that I worked, there was always someone, that I looked up to. What happened a lot of times is, back then the senior man was still a very important position. The officers didn't want to deal with the firehouse bullshit. The officers wanted to be officers. And so the senior men took care of the apparatus floor level of the firehouse, let's say. They took care of that, the kitchen. They took care of making the bunks, doing the laundry. They held people accountable. It didn't have to go to the office. If it went up to the officer, you were really starting to get into some, deep troubling times, that senior man. So I had several of them that I looked up to, depending on who I worked with. Because the one thing in New York City, we didn't have the four groups. It wasn't A, B, C, and D. We worked on a calendar that moved. So you worked with a whole group of people, usually two different officers, over the course of a 25-day cycle. And up to like nine other or 10 other different firemen. So you got a good exposure. So depending on who was working that particular day, that might be the guy that you went to and said, "Hey, can we go out and fly the tower ladder? Hey, can we go out and stretch? I've never used the deck gun." So each group had that guy that was the day's senior man. And those are the ones that you went to when you had the issues. You wanted to do something, you talk to them. So there's always been that mix in the firehouse. Always a guy that's going to want to go do something. We used to kid, if no one wanted to do anything that day, take the saw off the rig, go take it apart, because you probably couldn't put it back together. And then you had to ask somebody to come help you, and that would start to drill on the saw that day, But yeah, so I had a lot of mentors all through my career. All different ranks, all different positions. But like I said, every day almost it changed because you didn't always work with the same people.
Okay. All right. And so after, I'm assuming you stayed there for a little bit, and then did you bid for a new assignment?
So it's kind of interesting. Back then, there's always a subculture in the fire service. So the subculture back then was through the dispatches. And I went to 157 on what they called an onion skin. I was still assigned to 255, but I was working most of my tours in 157. And through them, I met a bunch of dispatchers who knew a bunch of other firemen. To make a long story short, back then it was 3 years till you turned first grade. So right before I turned first grade, I got asked to go to Rescue 4, which back then was pretty unheard of. But they were losing a bunch of guys to promotion on the beginning of the new lieutenants list. They were looking for people that they could get in there, that had some inkling of what they were doing. The Queensboro commander wouldn't let me go as a second grade firefighter. I had to wait a month and a half till I turned first grade. Then I went on a detail to Rescue 4. And Rescue 4 was a good place, great firemen. The problem then is none of the work was near their firehouse. Every run was like going out for lunch. We got to run the one morning. I get on the rig, I start getting dressed, and I look, and everybody else is trying to go back to sleep. And the one guy looks at me and goes, "If we get to the bridge, you can get dressed." Well, we were going to Far Rockaway, and you can't get to Far Rockaway except for by a helicopter. And we never made the bridge, so no one else got dressed. So I was having a real good time there, but one of the downsides was there was no first due work or early work, and they had the hazmat at the time. And a lot of people in the company were disgruntled because the job had gotten money to open the hazmat, but they didn't keep up with anything. They would send suits out to get repaired, and they'd come back worse than when they went out. So that was leading to some bad blood in the company, not amongst us, but against the job. And that, and the lack of the early work, the day the captain came to tell me I was going to be on the next order is the day I told him I wanted to go back to Brooklyn. So needless to say, I was gone pretty much immediately. I was on my way back to Brooklyn. Spent a couple more years in Brooklyn. I was an illegal alien at the time. I was living in New Jersey, which, we weren't allowed to do. So I decided I wanted to try to go to the Bronx. And again, that network of people outside the job connected to the job. I mentioned to someone I wanted to start looking at the end of the year so I could start the new year up in the Bronx. And 3 days later, I was in the Bronx and I wasn't ready to go. The company that I ended up in, I don't think was happy to see me. Because most times when you go to a new company, you talk to the captain. "Hey, Cap, I'd like to try to make a move, this, that." And I was plopped down like in 3 days. So it was kind of a culture shock. So I went up to the Bronx. I was in 92 Engine, great firehouse, and I spent a lot of time in the engine there. I'd work some tours in the truck, eventually went to the truck. And then from there, I went to Rescue 3.
I'd like to talk about Rescue 3. I know one is Manhattan, two's Brooklyn, three is no, I'm gonna say four Staten Island, right?
Nope, five.
Five. That's right. There's five rescues. I don't know where three is. Where's three?
So three was at that time on 181st Street in Manhattan, covered half of Manhattan and all of the Bronx. So it covered basically 116th Street on the east side of Manhattan, 125th Street on the west side of Manhattan, everything north of there, and all of the Bronx. So it was a real good spot. There was plenty of fires, especially wintertime. If we went out after midnight in the winter, we normally didn't come back to daybreak. You'd go to a fire in the Bronx, you go to a fire in Harlem, fire in the Bronx, back to Harlem. And quite a bit of fire duty. It was a good time. The end of the war years, but there was still enough around.
That's what I was gonna ask you. Just because I'm sure I'm not the only one, but people that love the FDNY, that buff the FDNY, you hear about the war years. And so since you had a part, you were able to have a part in that, my question to you is what was that whole experience like?
So the war years started in the 60s. That's when the fire duty really started. There was some riots. There were some, political figures that were shot. There was cops that were shot. So the busy time started in the late 60s. Dennis Smith's book, Report from Engine Company 82, was in 60s. He's talked about 1969. So it bled right into the 70s. But to me, what happened is, that 8231 area got decimated. Before they got real busy, it was just south of them, the true South Bronx. Harlem's been burning for 70 years. But the amount of fire duty is what made it kind of incredible. The New York City Fire Department started a program. They made second sections because companies were so busy. They said, "Well, if we make another fire truck with the same number, that'll cut the workload in half." Well, all it did is make them available for more runs. So they said 103 truck the one year did 7,000 runs. So they put another one, 103-2, in that firehouse. They both did 6,000 runs. They were just available more often. They're actually, I believe, trying a pilot program like that now with EMS runs. They've got a couple of chase cars that are supposed to take the CFRD runs for the engine. Well, the engine's still going to be available. So they're
Right.
just going to take the next one,
Right.
so it was kind of crazy. It continued into the 70s. It moved 82 and 31's area kind of slowed down. It moved up to the west side of the Bronx, 92, 44, 42, 75, and 33. That became the area. The other places still had fires, but not to that constant, rate that was experienced back in the true war years. Fires burned all the way into the 80s. There were still good fires. It was just spread out. So I caught the end of it. I was very fortunate to get any of it. Like I said, three, four fires a night was pretty normal, especially in the winter. And sometimes when the work came, it was just constant.
And I'm assuming with that experience, that's where all the knowledge, that's where all the skills came into fruition when it came to, because you actually went to these fires, you were able to apply your skill set to become a better fireman.
Yes, and I think the thing that's missing today is they don't realize I'm pretty much doing the same stuff I did when I was in probie school in 1979. I haven't had to change. Now, I'm sure there's some things I do that are a little different, but there's nothing I could put my finger on and said, wow, I wish they had taught me this back then. Right? So you went to fires, you did the same thing every time. And that's what makes it second nature. I went to a fire just a couple of years ago down in Christiana, and we had a laugh. We had the AARP engine, right? I was the nozzle man. The guy driving had as much time as me. There's three old timers out on the engine. So we catch a fire. It's a trailer home in a mobile trailer park. There's two of them going, one on that block, one on this block. And I go, so I get off the rig, I stretch the line, I put the line down, I kneel down and mask up. But because I've done it enough times, I'm not looking at myself doing it. I see the chauffeur pulling the rest of the pre-connect out of the bed. I see the officer going down the side. I look in the door, there's a couch across the entranceway. And when I was done, I was dressed. Right? So I was able to watch everything else that was going on. Because I didn't have to look at my mask, look for this, try to figure out where the regulator was. Where'd my helmet go? Always goes to the same place. Where are my gloves? They're under my knee. All those things, they just come automatically. And that gives you the advantage to watch everything else going on in the fire ground. And when you're done, you're dressed. And that's what we try to impress on, young people now is we don't run. We move with a purpose. We're looking at the fire building. When we get to our position, it took us 7 seconds longer to get in place because we didn't run, but our lines are flaked out properly. You're down. A lot of guys now mask up with their gloves on. I'm a cheater. I'm still one because I see a lot of guys when they do that, their hoods never end up right. A lot of practice. It's not the mask part, it's getting the hood over that. So now, guys, what do? Now they put their mask over their hood. They ride with the hood on, the mask out. Good, bad, or indifferent, I truly don't know. I like the fact that my hood protects my mask straps,
Okay.
right? So, I
Right.
mean, there's a lot of different things, but the whole point is we teach them to be good at those basic skills. The fire becomes the easy part. A good company officer is going to take that new, nozzle man deeper than he's ever wanted to go on his own. That's why the company officer is truly the most important part. Because he's the one that makes those decisions that the chief can't see, no one else sees. He's got the nozzle man. Hey, let's go. Let's talk. Give him the idea of what you want.
Okay. With, I don't want to say technology, but it astounds me that I'm going to probably say the air pack that you wore back in the late 70s and 80s were probably lighter than the air packs today, right?
By a mile, by a mile. It's sad.
You would think with technology, as things improve, you would think certain things like an air pack could get lighter, but they're getting heavier.
You know, part of it is the manufacturers. They have us over a barrel. They're on every committee the NFPA has. They make decisions for our benefit that truly isn't. The newest one is the when you get to a third of a tank of air, your alarm goes off. Used to be a quarter. You know, and we asked one of the manufacturers, why can't it be at a third if that's what you really want? They wanted half. But at a third, why doesn't it go off in my face piece? And then at a quarter, everybody hears it. Right? So what did the fire service do? Went to bigger bottles. Now we wear 45-minute bottles. Some places are wearing hour bottles. And what's still the number one cause of firefighter deaths? Heart attacks. So we've just made everything heavier. So Scott has a new wireframe, better air pack, 3 pounds heavier than the one I wore to start. And it's sad, but how do you fight them? They're making all the decisions, you know? So, you, like you said, you would think that with all the advancements that we would have an air pack, you know, that you'd stick in your mouth and that's all you had, you know? No tank, no anything else, just fresh air. But I don't know if we'll ever see it. You know, we tried to go back to 30-minute bottles in Christiana, but your operating time is cut so severely with the third of a tank. You know, we like the lightness, the movement. You know, you can go quicker with it. It's not dragging you down. It's tough. It's very hard.
All right. With that being said, I'm going to ask you, at what point in your career did you decide to move up to an officer rank and why?
So I took the first lieutenant's test I was eligible for, didn't study for it, didn't pass. You know, the New York City books are tremendous. There's so much information in them. And the way they write the test, they sometimes will reference exactly where it came from. And there were some discrepancies between firefighting procedures and the ladder bulletins. So they would quote, according to ladders three, this, and this. Well, in firefighter procedures, it said something a little bit different. So you really had to know the material. So as I moved up, you know, I was in Rescue 3, I decided it was time to start studying. One, as you get older, you know, it's a lot easier carrying a flashlight than it is to carrying the saw or whatever else you're doing. And I was really into the studying. And I was in a study group. And I was doing hours a day, and I was really ready for the test. And I did it mainly for myself, to advancement, and for my family. You know, I had two young kids with another one on the way. And it was just time. And I think most people realize there comes a time where, you know what, I'm going to be a boss. Sometimes it's working for people that you'd never want to be, you know, under them. You see other people studying. So I decided to study, put a lot of time into it. And then between the time I started really studying and the time that I took the test, I got hurt. And that put a damper on everything. I still took the test. I ended up passing the test. I think if I'd continued at the rate that I had been going, I would have been in the top 100 of the list because I had stopped studying for almost a year and a half and I still did fairly well on it. So I ended up taking it at the very end of the list. I turned it down twice because they were letting me stay. And then I took the last promotion and then retired from the job.
All right. With that being said, I'm going to ask you, in your opinion, what does the term aggressive mean to you? Because that is a buzzword in the fire service.
So that's pretty funny to bring that up. I had talked to someone else that does a podcast, and we were bullshitting. And he asked me to, I asked him, I said, what does aggressive mean to you? And he looks at me and he gives me all the, you know, the normal popular answers, you know. And I go, how about just learning your job and doing it well? That's what makes people aggressive because they've practice the skills. They understand fire. They see that opening. They go and do what they can do. And I gave them a couple of different examples. You know, a guy going in a window, VESing, and finding a victim and bringing them out, is that aggressive? Or is that just him knowing that he could get in that window and do his search and shut the door and find a person and get him out? So we give that label most times to things we don't think the general firefighter would do. And that now has become aggressive. You know, you look at somebody moving in with a hand line, you know, proper pressure, right nozzle, sweeping the floor, hitting the overhead, but continually moving. Is that aggressive or is that a good engine company? And to me, aggressive gets, it's not the right word for the fire service. I understand why people use it, but I don't believe it's the right word for the fire service. They're just skilled craftsmen that know their job. And I think other people look, go, wow, what an aggressive move. And I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool. That guy knew he could get in that window, make a search,
Right.
you know, and come back out. So there's a video from years ago out of Indianapolis. And second time they've been to this house that night, it's a domestic thing. House is on fire. They pull up, people are pointing. There's a lady in that window. So one of the captains throws a portable ladder. And as he's going up the ladder, you can see fire coming across the ceiling in that room. Gets to the top of the ladder, looks in, he can see the door. The fire that's on the ceiling is coming in the door. He's like, well, if I can get the door shut, you know, I'll be okay. Climbs in, gets to it, can't get the door shut. Something in the way, it won't close. Well, now the fire has gone almost to the window. Turns around, retraces his step. When he gets to the window, the fire's there now. Fire's over his head. So he does a head first ladder bail. No big deal. Comes down, goes back, you know, they pick him up, gets his gear back on, they go back to fighting fire. Well, it gets posted on the internet, and all the keyboard warriors are destroying this guy. You know, where is your officer? You want to kill yourself? What a terrible move. I mean, on and on. So I sent him a text. Hey, you're going to reply? He's like, no. Well, like 2 more days, he's had enough. So he gets on and he replies. This is what happened. Blah, 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 blah. My training kicked in. I knew I was fine. So now everybody that was saying what a suicide maniac he was 3 days earlier, I'm with you. What a great move, you know. So was that aggressive or was that him just knowing what he was capable of doing? And he said he would do it again tomorrow. He just wished the door had shut. If the door had shut, it would have been a non-event. And I think the neatest thing about it was they were wearing heart monitors as part of a study on heart disease for firefighters. So almost everyone on the fire ground had them on. And everyone that watched him, their hearts were higher than his was. Because to him, it was just doing his job. So pretty interesting. I'm not a fan of aggressive. You know, we can use it to let people know where we want to get to, but I think it's more skill-based and that whole culture of your fire department. Like if I know my engine company is a good engine company, I'm free to do the things I want to do. Does that make me aggressive or does that make me realize who the engine is? Because if it's not an engine that I have faith in, I'm probably not going to do the same things, right?
Right.
What makes me do these moves knowing that this engine company is going to go put that fire out? All right, so it's like I said, I don't have a better word, but I'm not sure if that's the best word to use all the time.
Understood. Okay, understood. You've seen a shift now with the fire service where there was a point in time where we actually the firefighters were more important than the civilians. And then a couple years ago, that shift started turning where it's like, no, the citizens are important because we have the gear and the SCBA and the things that they don't have if they're ever trapped inside a fire. They always say the fire service, it goes in a cycle. Like things repeat themselves. People try to reinvent the wheel. What is your take on on all of a sudden it's like, which I'm a fan of, but now we're again to the point where the citizens are first.
So that's an interesting concept, right? So you and me are making a search, and we're getting into some really bad territory, and we find a victim. And with that, you drop. You have mass failure, you have a heart attack, whatever it is. But I have to get you or the civilian out, right? Which one do I take? I take you. Because the only thing that lets me get to those places are the faith that the people I'm with are going to take care of me. How could I ever work with someone that said, well, you know what? Danny joined us, you know the risk. No, that's not right. You and I work together because I have the faith in you that you're going to get my rear end out and you will make a move because you know I'm there with you. And it sucks for the civilian, but the only way we get to do the things we do is the faith we have in everybody else and the trust that they're there for me. So I know the whole story how that started. It was a speech given at a national convention. I don't agree with it. I'm taking my fellow firefighter out first because the only thing that lets us keep doing what we do is the fact that I know you're coming for me. And if I happen to find a civilian and I can't take both, sorry for the civilian. Tough stand, but I believe it.
No, I respect it. I respect it. Okay. With that, so once you retired out of the FDNY, how did Christiana come about? Because I mean, they're in Delaware.
Yeah, so I got out with lungs, bad lungs. When I got on, there was no mask policy, the tough guy stuff. Then we had bottles, but we didn't have enough to get us through a whole tour. So I went to enough fires that my lungs started to get messed up. And instead of taking care of them myself, I kept pretending that they weren't going to get any worse. So when I retired, they had started getting better because I had stopped going to fires. If that makes sense.
Okay.
The body's pretty tremendous. It does a fine job. So I had been a member of the Montgomery Fire Department where I live, Montgomery, New York. I ended up being chief of department there. And I started going to fires wearing a mask 100 times more than I ever did in New York City. I exercise more now than I probably ever did in my career, which is another thing. And when I was chief in Montgomery, a friend of mine had moved to Delaware and he started riding in Christiana. And he said, you should really come down this place. It's crazy. It's the middle of Delaware, but extremely busy. So I started going down, and it was nice because I'd ride backwards there. I was a fireman there. I was chief up here with all the headaches that go with being the chief in a volunteer fire department. And I'd go down there and I'd just sit backwards and have the time of my life. Very busy, a lot of work. They're still doing about 100 fires a year. The ENS is doing over 4,000 runs now every year. We do 40 or 50 cut jobs a year. Got an interstate, got a couple of major highways. And, I was just riding there and I became a captain the one year. And that was really probably the best time because I was a captain of the truck and my son was the captain of the engine. And we went to a lot of fires together, which is, a great feeling. Then I moved up to assistant chief and just through attrition, I moved up to deputy chief. And that's where I am now. But I've been going there. You lose track of time. I think I've been going to 13 or 14 years now. And it's a place that still will produce firemen. We get a lot of young kids in there and they either become part of the process. And like I said, very successful. We've sent people to many big departments, but it instills in them what it takes to be a fireman. And I think that's what the success is.
Personal opinion question. How do you get chief officers to engage and think like firemen? Meaning the ability to never forget you are a fireman regardless of your title.
So there's no easy solution to that question because it's the bigger the department gets, You look at New York City, for instance. That chief of department never forgot where he comes from, but there's a thousand things on a day-to-day basis that cross his desk. A friend of mine became the chief of the Detroit Fire Department years ago. And he said, he says, I spent all weekend writing stuff out. This is what I'm going to do on Monday. I've got this plan. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. He gets into work on Monday. The pile of crap left on his desk from over the weekend, he never even opened his briefcase. He was just playing catch up, trying to solve problems, and it's, I think that's most big cities. On the other end of the spectrum is the slower places, the small places. And the problem there is that a lot of them don't have the fire experience to make them be good. So I've always believed that company officers are the strongest part of any organization. Because regardless of everything else that goes on, when there's a fire, they're going to make or break that operation. And when we embraced the incident command system, we gave weaker officers the excuse to stay outside to be the incident commander. So now we're sending untrained or less trained individuals in unsupervised. So then it became, well, I can pass command. Well, who'd you pass it to? Sometimes the first new ladder company, who instead of them now pushing the searches, they're standing on the front lawn. So we've kind of done a disservice, and now we have mobile command, roving command, all these things. So I'm a chief now. I run fires. I don't expect any of them to take command. I expect them to go do the task that they're supposed to do. I want the first new engine officer to push the line. I want the first new special service or truck officer to start my searches. I'm not a big radio guy. I'm not going to pester them. I'm not asking for canned reports, right? I'm letting them do their job. Now, I have my own clock, right? If I don't think that the conditions have changed to show that my engine's doing good, now I'm prodding them. If it's been an amount of time for the size of the building that I don't have a primary search, now I'm prodding the truck officer. But I'm not big on pestering them. They all have a job. The other thing I do different than a lot is I don't sit in the car. I stand in front of the building. Because when you have two engines and two trucks going to work at a decent fire, who's actually watching the fire building? They're all inside. What do they see? So I go one day, we have a real good fire, started, it's an outside-in fire, we call them. Started on the back porch, goes up the vinyl siding, right into the attic. So we get there, and it's in a place where there's not a lot of help coming real quick. So I end up with one engine and two trucks at the time. And I'm watching. I only have one line stretched because we won't charge the second line until we get hydrant water. And they've gone through the first floor, darkened down the first floor. But I'm watching the roof is starting to do this, starting to sag. Lightweight truss buildings. I look at the front door, there's a large half moon window over the front door. So in a lot of places, that means that that's a wide open foyer, right? So I look at that, I look at the roof starting to sag, I have no second line. I pull everybody out because when that drops, the only place it's going to land is on them. That stairwell, that staircase is going to be covered in flaming debris. I don't have a second line to protect them. So I pull them all out. And they're coming out. You can see the grumbling. And then like 90 seconds later, the staircase is on fire. And they're all like, oh. So I want to be able to watch the building. Now, if I'm going to put more than two and two into service, I am going to retreat towards the car because I have a command board. And hopefully by that point, there's another chief that'll help me set it up. If not, I kind of run them on the fly. I still want to watch the building until conditions improve enough that I'm comfortable with not staring at this fire building. Because no one else is. Right? And then a lot of people, oh, you got to be in the car, I roll up the windows or that. I don't agree with that. So the Mary Pang fire in Seattle, Washington, a long, long time ago, killed four firefighters. Chief never left his car. Never realized it was a multi-level building built on the side of a hill, even though the first company came up the backside and gave fire showing between the first and second levels. No one watched the building. Four firefighters died in that. So, I'm a product, I guess, of where I learned most of my fire duty, New York City. Their aide will run the board. They're standing in front of the building. They're watching that fire building. So that's the way I look at it. I will retreat to the board. If I have an apartment complex that we're losing and I know I'm putting a lot of companies in, then I have to have someone to help me track it. But for most of the house fires I go to, townhouses, I'm standing in front of the building until I get the troops started into their job. Then I'll tend to retreat towards the car.
Okay. And one of the things I liked you mentioned is the fact that you give the company time to do the work. And I think commanding officers of a scene that tend to every couple minutes can't report, give me a can report. Is that due to the inexperience of them going to the fires where they just rely on, hey, after 2 minutes, if I don't hear anything, I'm going to call them up and ask?
I think it's a combination of a bunch of things. One is less fire duty, but the other thing you have to think of, right? Time. What happens to time? It either elongates or collapses on us, right? So if I'm sitting in a car with a half a view of this house that's spewing smoke or fire through the roof, well, I'm sitting now, time to me is sitting in my car. I feel like I've been sitting out here for an hour with nothing going on.
Right.
That's the other reason I think you get a better sense of time in front of the building because you've watched them go in the front door. You can see the far window steam coming out of it, right? So I think everybody jumped on the bandwagon that being in the car is the place to be. That was a Brunicini thing. He taught it for years. There's a couple people now that's all they teach. And I think, like everything else, there has to be some kind of a balance. If I'm going to a 1,100 square foot ranch, if my two engines and two trucks can't put the fire out, back up the attack, search, ventilate if needed, then maybe my four companies need more training. And that goes back to the, well, who's pushing the lines? So funny story, this is fire many years ago down in Christiana, automatic aid to a neighboring department. So we're coming down the hill, there's a ranch style house. The whole back half of it's on fire. Fire is 20 feet up in the air already. So we pull up, me and my barman, we're right in the front door, and we could see the engine coming up the hill, laying a line, and we're sitting in there, and the fire is coming towards us. It's into the living room now, and we're sitting there, and I turn to my barman, and I go find the nozzle man. So he goes out to the front door, and there's the kid with the nozzle. He's never been to a fire before. He doesn't have an officer. Because they were riding light because they were at another fire in Maryland. He didn't know what to do. So my barman brings him in to me. And I always tell officers, you have to already know in the back of your mind what you're going to say to this kid, right? Because if you start stuttering or you don't have a plan, he's history. Now, we could have stole the nozzle. He would have gladly given it to us. But what does that do for him? So I'm like, and everybody laughs. I go, hey, how you doing? And he looks at me, because that's how I started. I said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to get water. You're going to make sure you're on straight stream. They had an automatic nozzle. I said, when you get water, we're going to hit the overhead. We're going to sweep the floor in front of us, and then we're going to go. And we got water, bled the line. He did fine. We got to the end of the hallway. We'd knocked down the hallway in two rooms already, and he shut down the line. And he goes, it's hot, but I can't see any more fire. So I look over, I go, well, turn your flashlight off. He put his flashlight on. And I call that, it's just a big security blanket. It makes you look down and go, okay, I'm still here. But what it does is it reflects off the smoke. You can't see anything else. He gets it. He goes, oh, there it is. I go, yep, right in front of you, and right in another room. Then the cavalry got there and they end up taking a line from the kid. But the kid did a great job. He did a hallway and 2.5 rooms of fire. Never been to a fire before, right? So fire gets all over. I go out and find them. I bring them back in and I walk them through everything that we did. This is where you knocked down the fire. This is where I told you to turn your flashlight off. Here's where you made that last turn. Here's where they took the nozzle from you, you know. But all we did is reinforce what we had done, you know. So I took a brand new kid to his first fire, or we could have stole the nozzle and the kids still haven't been to a fire, right? So that company officer, being the company officer for whoever's there, most times I find in the end it's the officer that doesn't want to go. Nozzle man wants to go to a fire, right?
Yeah, that's
You know,
right.
so you have to be able to balance those two things out, I think.
Okay. Quick thing. Back with commanding from the front yard. You know, one of the arguments I've heard, definitely through discussion, is, well, the incident command needs to have his windows up so he can concentrate on the radio traffic. While I agree that's important, I also feel like if you're going to be incident command in front of a structure, either you or your companies responding need to have the discipline to leave you alone.
So it's kind of interesting. So what does your department believe for radio traffic? Like I said, I don't talk on the radio that much. Well, neither do my companies because they're busy. You know, I'm not going to say it's radio silence, but if you're one of those places where you have to have the radio report every, you know, 3 minutes, tell me this, tell me that, I'm going up the stairs, I found a couch, I don't need that. That's your problem. A hole in the floor. I need that. That's a good thing to relay. So funny story. I'm an incident commander. We go on a rainy night, never go to fires in the rain. And we pull up and it's smoke in the house. You know, kind of common. So I'm letting the companies get in the street. I get down the street, I pull over. But as I'm looking, I go, wow, that does look like smoke. And I hear charge the line. I go, oh, I do have a fire. You know, you couldn't tell. So fire in the rear wall, started on a light fixture, ran up the back of the wall. So fire's over. Picking up the second line. And I'm going to talk to the homeowner. So I put my hand over the microphone. Because there's still some BS talking on it. And I'm explaining it to her. You had a fire in the back wall, it ran up the back siding. You know, there's a little bit of damage, blah, blah, blah. This is what we had to do. And as I take my hand down, I hear fireboard to Battalion 12, did you get the Mayday? So just prior to that, as I took my hand away, I hear two firemen trapped. So I'm thinking someone's running a drill and are on the wrong frequency, or there's another fire because mine is over. And with that, they go, Battalion 12, you get the Mayday. And I go, no. He says, two members under the rear deck. So I go right to the side yard. And what had happened was when they put this townhouse together, they used like 3-inch lags to hold the back sill board, not the sill, the header board of the deck onto the house. Well, they're prying, trying to get where the fire was, and the deck falls down. Well, in the basement, looking out the window, the officer's going to wash down. He sees two guys, said, they want you guys move. We're going to wash it down from here. And as they move, it falls. So he's the one that gave the Mayday. Right? So I get back. There's one guy, the deck is off. I might cancel the Mayday. But I said, you know, that's the interesting part no one talks about. This is what caused me to miss the Mayday. It wouldn't matter where I was talking to the homeowner. And he didn't want the radio chatter, you know? So the whole point, I guess, is things are going to happen, whether you're in a car, whether you're out in the front. But my belief is I'm going to prevent more things from happening watching the building until I have to put more companies into service. You know, had another little fire a couple of months ago, and second chief gets there and he comes out to me, he goes, I know you don't like the board, so I set it up over there. He set it up separate so I could watch the fire building. He took all the incoming companies, saw him set up, went to him, you know, sent the officers up if I needed something. So if everybody understands, that's fine. I know other officers don't want to use the board from the get-go. That's fine. It doesn't affect me either way. You know, my belief is that I'm more valuable watching a fire building at the beginning of the fire than I am in a car busy setting up a board.
Okay. All right. And I am a proponent, a big fan of PDAs. I'm pretty sure Christianity uses PDAs based on order of arrival, correct?
Yeah, so Newcastle County, where Christiana is, has the first alarm all set up. This is what you do by based on when you arrive. And there's blue card is out there, which was a Brunettini thing. I'm not a fan of that. It takes away, predetermined arrival assignments. I like, when I rode the tower down at Christiana, when I got off the rig, I gave them no orders. I didn't have to.
That's right. Everybody
Everybody's going
knows
to
their
where they're supposed
assignment.
to be.
Exactly.
And one of the things we always said, it's easier to call an audible from a play than not have a play.
Facts. Yes.
Right? So at any time, we can audible from what we're doing, but if not, everybody's going to where they're supposed to be. And to us, it's the only way the system works. The engine has to have the same discipline. If you're the third person on the engine, I don't want to see you running around in the backyard. You're feeding line to the first two people. I mean, that's the discipline. You talk about discipline in the fire service, there's two kinds. There's discipline when you get in trouble, right? That's bad discipline. And there's the discipline of running the fire ground where you have a job, do your job. Don't steal my job. Don't try to do my job. We'll have a fight over that. You do your job, I'll do my job. And that's discipline too. And that was a tough thing down in Newcastle County for a while. People jumping runs, trying to steal your line. All of a sudden, there's someone else in the fire room. Who are you? Well, what are you doing here? You're not supposed to be here. Go do what you're supposed to do. Your turn will come to get, what you think is the right place to be.
Right. No, and that's why I and some disagree. I've had conversations. Some people don't like it, but to me, if everybody responding on that first alarm knows their assignment upon their arrival, that's less radio traffic. People know exactly what they're supposed to do. And to me, there's no better gift to the citizen than mitigating the emergency as fast as possible. Like, there are times where you need to get on the radio, but there are also times where you don't need to ask what's the status report, what's your progress? Like, if you don't hear anything, companies inside are working. They're working to get to either the scene of the fire, completing that primary search, doing ventilation. And I understand, like, everyone has their opinion, but to me, I think PDAs are the way to go.
So we used to have SOPs and POAs. So an SOP is what you set up to happen ahead of time, right?
Right.
A POA was procedures on arrival. If you had to do something different than the SOPs, please let us know. I always thought one of the silliest radio transmission was engine one on the scene, have a fire in a 2.5-story frame. I'll be stretching an inch and 3/4 line on fire attack. Well, no shit. What were you supposed to be? Right? Now tell me that you're doing something different. Three people hanging out the second floor window.
Right.
All right, now the second door engine knows they're getting a fire. But why are you stating the obvious? First through truck, we have search. Again, that's unnecessary radio traffic. Just do the job you're supposed to be doing. It's set up in an order for a reason. It's written down for you to be able to study. It shouldn't be a surprise.
If I could ask, so, and I laugh because my department utilizes blue card. And ironically, I am in the lieutenant's process where I have been studying size ups and how we word things and things like that. We can go down that rabbit hole, but we won't. But I am studying and I'm trying to do what my department. That's my department's rule, so I have to abide by it.
You have to work within what you're given, yes.
That's right. But my question to you is, what would if you were on Christiana's first due engine responding to a structure fire, what does the radio size up sound like from the first in officer?
2-story, middle of the row, smoke show on second floor.
And that's it.
For a row of townhouses, yep.
Okay.
Not
That's
tell
it.
they'll tell us, so normally what you'll hear is laying out from Smalley's Dam,
Okay.
that's the cross street, right? Or leading out to a hydrant at such and such an address. So you'll hear that first, laying in from so and so, and then on the scene, two story, middle of the row, smoke showing, first new engine. All right, that lets everybody knows they got there. They got their own water supply. All right, second new engine will go to that hydrant where they dropped from to ensure the water supply. First dude special gets to the front of the building. Second dude truck tries to get as close as they can. Third dude special or rescuer truck is going to be the RIT. The third and fourth engine get a second hydrant and do the same thing.
Gotcha.
So we're getting two water supplies, two special services as close to the front of the building as we can. And then everything else is laid out what your job is.
Okay. And then if the fire is not as extensive as it seems, that first due company officer can then advise units, other units responding in, hey, you can cancel the second water supply. We've got it under control.
So in Christiana, they would go to command.
Okay.
Engine, Tower 12 to Battalion 12, the food on the stove, no extension. We need ventilation. I would get on and say, hey, 28, don't drop a second line.
Okay.
And they would stand fast. We made sure we had no extension. Then we'd reduce it to usually the first four companies. And that's just to pick up the line. But it's another nice thing about Newcastle County is just about everybody's bought into the fact that they want to be firemen. So I always have a little story that I think shows it. We get a run one night into Newark. We go on their box alarms. We send an engine truck and the chief will go. So we're coming back to Christiane and they call the engine and truck. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning. And they go, engine 12, tower 12, automatic fire alarm, 840. 8:30, whatever it was. What the heck's the name? I'm drawing a blank on the street.
That's
But they give
fine.
out this assignment, So Harmony Road. So I don't go any automatic alarms in the middle of the night, So I'm just cruising back. And I go, yeah, this is a call from a group home. There's a language problem. But when we asked if they wanted the fire department, they said yes. So I'm like 2:30 in the morning. Group home saying they want the fire department. So I have a Battalion 12 fire board, give me the box. And they're like, are you there? I go, well, no. But they're saying that they want the fire department. It's a group home. So, you can hear the dispatcher being a little snarky. So they send out the box. So we go to the first address, 808 South Harmony Road. And first new engine drops the line, stretches to the front door, truck's up there, banging on the door, getting ready to force it. And this little old lady comes out. And goes, can I help you guys? So I'm just getting her in the car, and on the list of runs, I see 808 Old Harmony Road. This is South Harmony. So I go to the dispatcher, can you check the address? And he's like, 808 Harmony Road. I go, well, I also see 808 Old Harmony Road in the queue. Is there a chance that's where we're supposed to be? And now I get that silence, So luckily, Engine 9 coming from Newark says, Battalion 12, you want us to start out for the other address. So they go there, they drop 700 feet of supply line, stretch a line, everybody else goes there. Make a long story short, now we have two incidents, mile apart, where between the two, there's over 1,000 feet of hose laying in the street. And I stand there, it's 3 o'clock in the morning now, and the Congo line has formed to put the hose back. Nobody's bitching. All they want to do is be firemen. They're bullshitting, breaking balls, right? Packing line. Half the crews went to the other place, picked up the original lines. No one was complaining. They just want to be firemen. They want to do fireman things. And the more you encourage it, and the more you say, no, this is what we do, it does become that thing. It becomes the culture that everybody wants to be a part of. They look at you and they go, wow, that's a great thing. Why do you guys do this all the time? Well, that's what we do. We're good at doing it. We want to stay good at doing it. So we do that, And it's successful. That's the thing, I guess. It's been very successful.
And I'm a fan of that. I'm a fan of if you get a box alarm of a possible structure fire, smoke in a building, regardless of fire showing or not, those repetition, like for me, where I work at, where I live, we don't get the fires that Christiana sees. But what that does for me as a fireman and the other firemen that I have in the back with me, it gets us that practice because we don't get to see those fires. And I can't stand when people are like, oh, why'd you pull a line to the front door? We don't have to charge it, but it gets the fireman that experience of stretching to the front door, getting his bread and butter basics down.
It's like when I talked about masking up.
Right.
It becomes second nature. You don't have to worry about the stretch. The stretch is going to happen. That's the thing. You took away that thought process. No, this is the 15th time we stretch in 3 days. We stretch on every box alarm because the newer people need the repetition.
That's
You
right.
don't want the first fire to be their first fire.
That's
You want
right.
them to go through this process. So, oh, what a pain in the ass, you know, flaking off. Yep. But hey, now when it's on fire, what do we have? We have a line at the front door, properly flaked out, and a nozzle man getting dressed while the backup chases kinks. End of story. Now all I have to do is open a line and go. Now it's the right way to do it, but people complain. And you know, it's the real busy and the real slow to complain the most. The ones in the middle want to be better. And
Right.
to me, that's always the thing, you know. As an officer, you want to encourage your people to try to get better every day. If there's something missing or something you can do to get them, like, you know, Christianity, we wanted to drill every day. And we take a drill mark, you know, and those are the formal drills. But there's probably, on some days, 10 drills a day. It's two people going over the rip pack. It's two people doing the saws, talking about them. You know, it's all those small things. And it's a group of senior men. You know, and sometimes it's not the senior guy. It's just guys that are interested in making the place better. And the more you do, the more people, you know, someone's sitting at the table at the back of the bay watching three people going through a compartment and pulling stuff out. If they don't get up, they're the problem, not the three people going through the rig, right?
Right.
You should be investing your time. We used to have the blue door at that firehouse, and that was the thing. You'd be sitting there, you know, and you'd hear bang, bang, and someone else would get up. Bang, bang, bang. Someone else would get up. And eventually everybody's in there forcing doors. You know, and that's what you want. You want that. You're guilty if you're not participating. And it comes and goes in waves. You know, some days you're never gonna get everybody. You know, when I used to do a lot of teaching, I used to tell people it's the 1-3-1 phenomena. And it's 1-3-1 or, you know, 20, 60, 20, however you want to break it down. But I used to go to do a class, you know, and I'd look and there's 10 people in a room. Well, I'm looking at the two old timers in the back. They've already checked out, right? No matter what I really say, they're not participating today. The two young kids in front, everything I say, they're on every word, right? They're brand new. This guy must know what he's talking about, whether I do or not, but they're writing stuff down, they're taking notes. Well, the ones you want to work are the three or six in the middle. You want to bring them up to the front. You want to make sure there's information that gets them engaged, not sends them to the back of the room, if that makes sense, right? So
Right.
you're trying to get that middle group that can go either way to step up their game. So you have to have something for them. You have to have something for the young people. And you're not giving up on the people in the back, but they're going to be a harder sell. That middle of the group is the group that you want to try to get up and get them engaged in what you're doing. So I've used that my entire career. I'm
Okay.
just looking here. Box going out in for Christiana.
Imagine that. With that, with you being a deputy chief there, what is one of your non-negotiables for anybody that's looking to come into that department?
So we run a vetting process pretty much. If you want to join Christianity, you have to come for three ride-alongs first.
Okay.
You have to come, invest your time. They're using 9 to 9. If you come from a distance, you know, we'll make accommodations. You can stay overnight so you're not putting out 1,000 miles. So we accommodate you that way, and that gives you an idea of what we do and how we are. And you know, we kid around, like I'll ask them, is this your third ride along? And, oh yeah, what'd you do on the first two? Nothing. Well, don't come back then. And they look at you all panicky, and I'm like, I'm only kidding. So that gives them an introduction of what we're like. And you'd be surprised, some people don't come back. The
Okay.
pace isn't what they were looking for, or the discipline, I guess, isn't what they were looking for. You know, mopping floors, cleaning toilets. It's all the stuff we do. Someone's got to do it in the firehouse, right?
That's right.
So after that, we run we used to run full-size rookie schools, 18, 20 people. We're now trying to adapt it. So if you complete your ride-alongs, get your application in, get your background check, we'll do you as an individual. Because if you miss the last one and we were waiting for 15 more people, it could be months,
Right.
right? So we do basically a one-day class now, and it's to get you cleared to ride the engine. And we realize almost everyone that comes to us are firemen someplace, but you got to learn our way. If you're going to be successful in our system, it has to be the way we do things. Not that you're doing it wrong. For where you're doing it, you might be 100%, but this is the way we do it. And it's a half a day of, stretching, packing, moving and flowing. We do a little bit forcible entry with them because the engine sometimes is without the truck. But basically, layout, we use UMAT valves, the deck gun. We try to teach you everything that the engine does in that one day. And then it's all about the time you want to invest. If you come down, one of the neat things about Christiana is that they try to give the junior man a nozzle all the time. So we had a young lady move in, lived in a firehouse for I guess closing in on 2 years, but that's all she did. She rode fire trucks, and she had like 20 something nozzle fires her first year. How great is that? Where can you go and have 20 nozzle fires,
Right.
in that short of time? And we've had a lot of that. If you move in when there's not a lot of live-ins, if you're there, you're getting the nozzle.
Right.
And so that just builds right into what we try to do. Once you're there, we look at you, how you perform doing the engine stuff. We know some of you are close to being truck qualified, so we can clear them on the cannon and the irons and the ladder position. No one joins gets qualified as OV. Our OV works alone, against most of the rules, gives us our seaside report. But unlike most places, our OV is always looking to get in the window. Some people say it should only be targeted when you know someone's in there. But the way we look at it is if I only let you do it when I know someone's there, how good are you at doing it? If I let you do it every opportunity you have, now your only decision is go or no go. Right? You lattice place, you're up, you're it, you're to the window, you take the window. That's all you have to decide now. Can I get in there or not? If everything else hasn't been done 50, 100 times, I don't know if you're going to get to that position. So our OV will take a ladder to the rear, give a seaside report, because our officers do not do 360s. He'll give that seaside report and then he'll try to identify a window to get into.
And when you say that, you mean your truck officers, or is it any officer?
No
No
officers do a
officers.
360.
Now you see that right there, I'm sure is keying the safety patrol.
Oh,
Like,
absolutely.
so if we could just, I just
I've
want to
been
hear
doing
your
this
take
50
on
years.
it.
I've never done a 360. So in Montgomery, where I live, I have a Medline warehouse. It's
Okay.
1.5 million square feet.
Right.
Is that the one you want to do the 360 on? We give you a bicycle and cab fare because the building's so big. Right. So I know places have to have it. The biggest reason we do it is it got pushed after a fire in Ohio where two firefighters went through the floor and got killed. I was the one that really was pushing on everybody. But nowhere along the line did we try to identify how to tell from the front of the building if there's a basement fire. There are clues. There's a lot of things that you can learn from the front of the building to clue you in on the fact that this might be a basement fire. But even that was not counting that. So when I pull up to the building, I see one side of the building. I see the front of it. And if I'm on the engine, I pull past, I see the third side.
Right.
If anything, I'll go down the side of the building and peek around back. But there's no reason, if there's nothing that makes me say, oh, I better go check, there's no reason I'm going to go run around the building and pass the side I already saw. So I kid around with people. I'll do a 271, three
Okay.
sides and a peek.
Right.
but I'm not going to waste the time if I don't need to, if that makes sense.
Okay.
We did a live burn years ago in Ohio, and very obvious second floor, front bedroom fire. You could see the fire licking around the window frame. We had to use the safety line twice, or we would have burned the second floor off this house because 360s were new. This guy was giving us every piece of information he could possibly think of. And by the time he got back around the front, we would have burned the second floor of the house off. So if there's something that triggers it, I'll never say don't do that, but it has to have a trigger to do it. If I'm going to do anything, like I said, I'll do the 271, three sides and a peek around the back. But I'm also teaching our people what to look for at the front door for basement fires. Right? So forcing the door. What do they teach you after you force the door? Door pops
You
open.
usually keep it open, kind of see the neutral plane, see where the smoke's going to. Any victims, close the door back until the line's
Right?
ready.
So that was always the thing, right? Used to be to shut the door right away. Now we've realized that there's information. So what is the smoke going to do? What does the smoke tell you? So if the smoke starts filtering out of my opening, where's the fire? It's either
Up,
upstairs that bank down,
okay.
especially in newer homes, or it's at the rear of my level.
Okay.
If I get that middle of the door, smoke coming out, fresh air going in, where's the fire most likely? My level, not at the front door. If it was at the front door, the smoke would be dropping.
Okay.
Well, you open the front door and the smoke comes out and then fills right back up. Where's the fire most likely?
Right there.
Or
In a basement.
in the basement, because it's being fed from below. So
Okay.
what else do we look at the front door? We look at the sill plate, right? Because most times the flooring doesn't go all the way outside. It's covered by a sill plate. There's little cracks. We check the baseboards to both sides of the front door to see if there's any smoke signatures coming out of the baseboard. Right, there's so many things that we can look for, but we don't let people know them, and that's part of it. No one wants to fall through the floor, right? So we have to tell them what to look for there. Does the first line still need to go to the front door? I got a confirmed basement fire. I got a walkout door in the rear. I can go right in. Where's the first line have to go? Does it get to go around
I'm
back?
gonna say it could go around back.
Yeah, it can. If your truck is searching, you have to keep that, you have to stay at that front door to protect the searches. It sucks. Second door engine gets the fire, right? But if they're going in over ladders or they scooted up the stairs, your job now is to protect that egress. If they got to come out, because if you don't, the fire burns through the top of the basement stairs, it wraps right around, goes right upstairs, right? So that's one of those times where the discipline for the engine company is they have to hold that position till the searches are done and the second engine gets to get your fire. Sucks. Real life. Too many times the first one goes around back and they leave the first floor. And next thing you know, the first floor is roaring because there's no one there to protect the first floor.
Okay. All right. Like I said, it's just I don't, as long as I've been in it, I love hearing little tips and tricks because we don't have very many basements here. We do have some basements, but we don't have very many. And so, it's just one of those things what to look for. Knowledge is power. Hoarding that information does nothing for the fire service. It doesn't get
No,
anybody better.
when people ask, you share the information. But, like I said, the problem now is that it's the internet. You could put whatever you want up there. There's going to be a group of people that are going to believe it. And you can't be like that either. It's got to be tested. I've always told people that having knowledge without experience is just theory. Right? Because you've never applied it for yourself. You have to apply that. Everything from forcing doors to getting dressed to stretching a line to operating a line, until you find what's good for you, you have an idea because you read about it. But until you put it to use, you go, no, that is good. I can use that. Or no, ooh, I'm going to go back to what I used to do. You need experience. And if you don't have real fires, that's what that, drilling, that stretching every day, throwing a ladder, all that stuff that everybody hates, that's what makes you good.
Right. Okay. And I'm assuming you are a fan of engines doing engine work, trucks doing truck work. But it all probably, I would say too, it also depends on, because you mentioned the department where your dad was chief. He did what he had to do because he knew, hey, I don't have the manpower.
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah. In a perfect world, everything is properly staffed and they're all coming,
Right.
but that's the perfect world. But yeah, even in the imperfect world, engines still have to get water on the fire. Like I said, I used to do a lot of classes. So I'm the first two truck boss. We pop the door. We're going to go in. What am I looking for? I'm the truck boss, right? What's my first job? What do you think my
Search.
first job? Find a fire.
Well, normally, but okay, I got you.
I'm saying I'm in front of the line.
Okay.
So now I'm looking for the fire.
Right.
Because until I identify where the fire is, we're at risk. I can't run up to the bedrooms if the fire's in the first floor kitchen, right? So if
Right.
I once I find a fire, I'm good. Now I
Right.
can send my crew to search. I can get the engine to where they need to be, and then I go join the search. So, these people are like, oh, you go in the front door, you go right upstairs. Well, no, you don't. You find the fire first. Because once you find the fire, we're good. My people are, I'm between the fire and the front door, and they're between me and the front door. I can get them out of there, but you have to find a fire.
Okay. We're almost towards the end here. I was fortunate I got to interview your son, and talking to Mike, he talked about Christiana, how Christiana developed him through the endless amount of calls, this experience he was able to get. And then eventually he wanted to go somewhere bigger and he got on the FDNY. So I don't get to ask this question a lot, but so I wanted to ask you, what does it feel like to you seeing your son a part of an organization that you were on?
Oh, it's a great feeling, he's made his own name for himself, which is tremendous too. I've been out a long time, so a lot of people, they might have heard the name, but not many people still knew me,
Right.
and he had to stop off in Wilmington. He was a fireman in Wilmington, Delaware for 7 years. Made a name for himself there, whether right, wrong. Some people hated him, some people loved him. But he took some of the things that he developed in Christiana to Wilmington. And some places like, well, we don't do that here. Well, he goes, well, I do. That makes me better at what I do. And he's taken that mindset with him to New York City. So his first, 18 months, he's on probation. You don't say too much, but he's off probation now. And now he does question and he does speak up, and he's using the things he learned to be better at what he does there. He just had a real good, he caught a real good piece of a fire he had no business having any of because he conserved his air. He was the doorman, the last guy on the line, but found himself a place at the top of the stairs where he was out of the smoke enough so he didn't put his face piece on. And they had trouble in the fire apartment. They lost a member. First, the engine came out, his company went in. And they all ran out of air because they were up there on air waiting to get into the apartment. So the boss said, hey, we need relief. So Mike put his face piece on, went up, said, I'm good, boss. And he got the rest of the fire. So it's stuff that he's learned that he uses. And actions will always speak louder than words. People see that. They just had a guy get burned because they didn't get low enough. And Michael goes, I go to a couple of fires, I'm the only one crawling. Well, that's our turnout gear has made us invincible, right?
Yes,
But he was
sir.
always taught to crawl, so he's down low. It's all those little things, and now people are watching him do his thing, like people watch me do my thing. And you can like what I do or not, but I'm doing me and he's doing him. So it's a great feeling. He should have a tremendous career.
That's awesome. And my last question to you, what advice could you give to people? Because as sad as it is to say this, firemen, the term brotherhood, like we show up and show out for those in need, but man, can we tear each other apart? We tear guys down that try to I go to outside training and try to bring a different perspective, a different mindset, and it's like, nope, you think you're better than us, and whatever all the case may be. So what advice can you give to a firefighter that attends these conferences? Because they're not, unfortunately, you can only do so much for your organization. If your organization goes to fires, great, but we have some that don't. So that's why, for me, that's why I go to outside training, because I
Yeah.
get the knowledge and the experience and the fires. I will pay to go to a hot class, so I want to get some fire under my belt. What advice can you give to those individuals?
So first of all, you can't give up, right? I mean, you're making yourself better whether they want you to be or not. So you continue doing you. When you have a chance to interject, you bring it up. If they're not a fan of it, doesn't really matter. Most of the people that are the naysayers, you're going to outlast anyway, right? So you have to make yourself the best that you can be. What happens when you get better on the fire ground? Who notices? Other people,
Other people, yes.
right? Why'd you do that? Well, I'd gone to this class and they showed us this and it worked real well, so I've started doing that. And that gets other people, especially when you're younger coming on the job. How much time you have on the job you're at?
18 years.
18 years, right? So you've been doing it a long time. You're still trying to perfect different things.
Yes.
If you get promoted, what's your crew going to think of you? Well, you're going to have the guy that, regardless of what you say, you're going to be wrong. That's fine. You're going to have the one that's newer, that, oh, new boss, let me see what he wants to do. So setting the tone for your company starts the first day. Your expectations. This is what we're going to do. If you don't like it, I'll see if I can get you transferred. I can get you to another company. I'll take someone else that wants to do it. Right? But you keep trying to make yourself better. People do notice. And some notice for the wrong reasons, but you have to keep being you. You have to keep doing the stuff that makes you good at what you do. So I taught at FDTN since its beginning, Fire Department Training Network. And I have a couple of letters that I saved over the years from people with 19, 20, 23 years that came out there and basically, what a humbling experience. I've been doing this 20 years. I'm an officer. I never knew what I didn't know. And basically, what happens when you're in a system, too often we try to change us into that system instead of letting you grow. And maybe moving the system to a better place. So these guys were in a system that worked for years until they were shown it was something else. And they're like, wow, where did that come from? Why didn't I know this 15, 18, 20 years ago? And that's the thing. You're, like I said, you've done it a long time. You're going to find stuff. I'm still searching for stuff to make my job easier. It's just that, there's that saying, the day you stop learning in the fire service, you should retire. I've always said, it's harder to find someone to teach you. And that's not being arrogant. It's being the fact that the basics have gotten me here. They haven't changed. I'm doing the same things I've been doing for 50 years almost. And, there's little modifications, but I spend like too much time on the internet laughing at people. And I sometimes will throw in a little something, when I see it's completely ridiculous. They posted something about CAM reports the other day, and I had in a podcast said, I think they're stupid. And all these people, and basically what I ended up saying is, no, if my officers need something, they're calling me. They're not waiting to get prodded, right? Does your department do par checks? Does your department?
We do CAN reports, and par checks are more, I think, if like something bad goes on, but we definitely do CAN reports because that's something I had to learn.
So par was that was the perfect one. It's slowly gone away, except for like you said, if there's a problem. What did they used to say? You should get one every 10 or 12, whatever silly time they came up with, every 15 minutes get a par. So I used to say, okay, so engine one, you have par? Yes, I do. So I call them 15 minutes later, right? Engine one, you have par? And the officer goes, thank God you called. I've been missing Fireman Smith for 14 minutes. Right? They're not smart enough to call if they're missing somebody. Then they're not officers. So we dumb down stuff because I wrote an article that makes me good at it. And it's not the way it's supposed to be. Treat your officers, tell your officers to be officers. They're not friends, they're bosses.
Right.
And that's a lot of the problem. People want to be liked. Well, I don't need any more friends. I don't have that many to begin with, right? I have a lot of acquaintances,
Right.
but when I do my job, I believe in doing my job correctly.
But also, I'm sure you also believe in making sure that the person that's going for officer is the right person. And I say that because we all know of somebody who is a lieutenant or a captain rank, officer rank, that should have no business being in that position. But unfortunately, whether it's through manpower, attrition, whatever the case may be, these individuals who don't need the job raise their hand, I want to get promoted and get it.
Absolutely. And that's never going to change.
Right.
It's a sad statement, but that's not going to change. And then on top of it, they start their career and they do poorly on it, but no one now wants to take it away. So I'm at FDTN a couple of years ago. We're doing basement fires. First fire, guy comes up and he goes to me, "Yeah, excuse me, do you know where Jimmy is?" I go, "Nope. Anything I can do for you?" He goes, "Yeah, I have no business being here. I want to leave." And he had been in fire prevention for 18 years, got promoted, and they put him in a company. He hadn't been to a fire in 18 years,
Right.
right? And he was petrified. I gave him so much credit. Now, I don't know what happened when he went back to his fire department, but I give him so much credit for that, that he spoke up and said, "Nope, I shouldn't even be here." But unfortunately, these people that get promoted, they then hide. They're terrible officers. They don't know how to discipline people. They're the guys that stand in the front yard, right? That's all what's wrong with what we do. And unfortunately, most places they give a test, they're doing interviews. New York City is time on the job and your test grade. You get points for experience. And I'm sure there's some people that aren't happy because not enough of their chosen people are getting jobs. But to me, it's at least fair. I hate where there's a list, but no one gets to see the list, right? How
Right.
did that guy pass that test?
Yeah.
And you look at it and you go, "Listen, that's the culture of this fire department." So I just have to do the best I can do in the position that I'm in.
Okay. With that being said, my last question to you, I always like to ask the guests. You've retired from the FDNY, but you're still heavily involved in the fire service. So when that time comes, when you decide to hang it up, what's next for Bob Pressler?
Good question. It's pretty funny. So I look at people that are out there teaching stuff, and a little backstory. A guy wrote a book several years ago on search, and he hadn't searched in probably 15 years. He became a chief. He's battalion chief, assistant chief. I believe he ended up being chief of training. So how did he know what the current search techniques were? And he put a statement in there that we're still fighting today because it's reared its heads again. You never had to take a tool with you when you were searching. You could leave it at the door. So he never worked in a place, I guess, that had child gates, that had rooms off rooms, that all those things where you might need a tool to breach a wall to get out because the fire took off. So I've always felt that if you're teaching strategy and tactics, or you're teaching the basic stuff, you have about a 2-year window when you stop riding where I don't think you're as relevant as you think you are. Now, if you're teaching strategies, command stuff, that can go on forever, right? Because a lot of that is theory. This is how I did it. This is what worked for me. But the actual doing of it, I think your window starts to shrink. And I'm going to say where you're relevant. That's not probably the right word because you can stay relevant for a while, but it's harder if you haven't touched the Halligan in 10 years. I don't think I should be learning from you.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So I'm on my downside now. I'm just slowing down. I've been riding in the car. Part of that is because I don't want to be a burden either. You got to be the smartest guy in the room that tells you when it's time to stop riding fire trucks.
That's right.
I haven't been told yet. I've been telling myself, but I haven't been told yet, and I don't want to get told. So I spend most of my time in the car now. I don't know. I probably have 90,000 slides and pictures of fires and training, stuff I've shot over the years, completely disorganized. I can't remember where half of them were. I collect fire memorabilia, as you can see from the back of my room. Try to get that organized. More time at home, it's coming. It's
Right.
going to come for everybody. I'm just fortunate that I got to enjoy it as long as I did.
Okay. Love that. All right. Chief, well, I thank you for number one accepting the invite, coming on and talking shop. I you don't understand the joy I get from picking your brain, having these conversations, getting to hear your mindset and the way you do things through your experiences. So I just have to say thank you very much for coming on.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
I appreciate you.
No problem.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.